questions and comments. Yes, sir. Why don't you introduce yourself, please?
I'm David Zack, and if I have a title or association, it's with Massachusetts Peace Action, Palestine-Israel Working Group. I'm interested in what's left out of this egalitarian vision, the binational alternative. You mentioned 181 and 242, but the UN and its associated agencies have been very much involved in the last few years in coming to recognize Palestine. That whole dynamic seems to be, not taken into account in what I've heard you say. So if you could take it into account. Also, you mentioned Hussein Zumlau. I heard him say something that I hadn't thought about a couple months ago when he suggested that what happens to all of the settlements, all the building, all of the activity, if you're pursuing a binational state, suddenly that's legitimized. That doesn't go away. Because I don't think that's part of the dismantlement of the rights that you're talking about. So those are two questions I would put to you.
Do you
want to
take a couple of questions?
However you prefer, to respond. However you prefer, if you want to add a few questions, we can, if you want to.
I'll just take this one and then maybe
we'll take a couple
more.
Okay.
You're right. There's very little in the material that I've read that they've produced which relates to this drive for recognition through the UN. There is some, actually. I didn't mention it because I suppose, can't get everything in. I mean, they produced this little book. I could have read the whole thing out. We'd have been here for 2 days. I think, mentioned in connection with, I wouldn't say, desperation on the part of Palestinians, but as a path which is being taken, which obviously is trying to say that the peace process as being run by the Americans and the Quartet and so on is failing, and any talks between Israel and Palestinians are just never going to get anywhere. But this is being used really as a kind of a tool or a strategy that is one time being pushed forward, then drawn back from, and other times being pushed forward, because the Palestinians have felt it so important, the PA, to keep good relations with the Americans, and also to keep, in a sense, good relations with the Israelis. I think there is a sort of a feeling that yes, this is an important thing. This is one possible path, but up to now it hasn't really been pursued consistently. And if I'm not mistaken, there was a time when they kind of parked the idea for a bit, and then they came forward with it again. It doesn't conflict with the equal rights agenda. I mean, it could actually go with it, because as I say, using the UN is an idea that has come through from some of the people writing about the equal rights idea, in order to get a resolution which would talk about a state where everybody has equal rights. Indeed to do that. So I don't think this rules out that, but obviously I think the important thing is to understand that the people who are developing this kind of discourse are to a certain degree rebelling, if I put it that way, against some of the traditional ways that have been used over the last 20, 30 years to pursue peace, which is this kind of top-down thing. And in some ways, the UN is both kind of top-down and bottom-up in a sort of a sense, because you're going to actors at the UN which are, in a way, some of them very much outside of any kind of consensus about, a sort of Western consensus about what should happen. But it is trying to get to a kind of back to basics sort of thing. And so therefore, I suppose they're not that interested at the moment in talking about efforts that are being made at the UN as far as recognition of Palestine is concerned. And then, I mean, the point you raise about legitimizing the settlements, I mean, obviously, I think I sort of raised this in the remarks that I was making, that that clearly that's the last thing that they would want to do, is to put themselves in a position where it makes it look as if they're saying it's okay. And I don't, I mean, I haven't got the answer to it, and I don't know what their answer might be in the longer term. I mean, to be fair, this is a process which is not really very old. It's only a couple of years, this kind of discussions about equal rights at this kind of level, and clearly they have to deal with these kind of very fundamental practical issues. And I'm stumped. I mean, I haven't got an answer. You know, I think we need to hear from them more about this to see, I suppose, what kind of allowing of the current settlements. I mean, obviously, it would be absolutely intolerable to begin a process like this if it meant that the colonial project was going to just carry on at the same time, because what would be left at the end of it in terms of, you know, historical connection with the land as far as the Palestinians are concerned. But there may be some degree of readiness to sort of, it's okay if there's an agreement to halt things where they are and then, you know, pursue the equal rights agenda within some legal framework, that once you get further down the road with achieving some measure, greater measure of legally backed human equal rights, you may be able to get a greater consensus about dismantling the settlements, because you're changing possibly the atmosphere overall in Israel-Palestine. This is a bit hopeful sounding.
Yeah, let's take a couple of questions and then we'll put them to him. Ali, and then yes, ma'am.
I very much applaud.
Could you introduce yourself?
I'm Ali. Sorry, I'm Ali Banu Azizi in the Political Science Department here. I very much applaud your humanitarian and egalitarian vision and the really incredible judiciousness with which you presented the issues. My question is, if one were to look at the forces that have impeded the achievement of the two-state solution or any progress, any real progress in that direction, how would those forces, and I'm referring obviously to Israeli politics, how would they map on to this vision, and would the impediments in your judgment be greater with this vision than with the two-state solution? And just as an add-on to that question, wouldn't the cynic argue that this vision could actually prevent any progress, that it could become a palliative and a kind of a, you know, ephemeral thing in the air, which would not only be helpful given how entrenched the opposition and resistance there has been in Israel. And if you look at contemporary Israeli politics, obviously that would be the conclusion that one would draw. So if you could comment on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to take a couple of Syria out of here.
I was wondering if you could comment on why... Ellen Winter in psychology.
Yeah.
Why do you think that even Israelis on the left are so opposed to this idea? I assume it's because they think it's a dangerous idea. And I'm wondering if you could comment on what the indication... What the signs would be that this would not... If this were put into place, that this is failing. And what about the issue of the Jews becoming a minority and laws being passed that then oppress Jews?
Are there any other questions about Israeli politics right now that people were waiting that we could pile on? Okay, why don't you start with those and we'll circle back to other questions.
Sure, sure. The forces that impede the two-state solution also impede the equal rights agenda? Well, obviously they would. But I think that the fundamental thing that people who are talking about the equal rights agenda are starting with is that the two-state solution is first. Is so impeded to the extent that it really is dead, that it's just not going to happen. You can maybe never say never, but certainly in the current climate, since it's not, the problem is it's not just the impediments to it within Israeli politics, I think, that it's also the lack of will on the part of the international community to take the steps that could have been taken. It's not beyond. It's not fantasy to have thought that Obama could have had the power to change things. It has happened in the past when an American president did force the Israelis to take a different course, or I think twice in the past. So it's not. I think it's not just a question of Israeli politics. It's also a question of failure of will to go far enough and to push far enough on the part of the international community. I think that it seems to me that the key thing about the equal rights agenda idea is that, this in some ways, I don't hear them saying that this is modelled on sort of the American civil rights movement. But I think in some ways it is. It speaks to me as if it is. And of course, that was not about, some kind of top-down force taking action to achieve this. It was, blacks coming together with other allies to claim those rights for themselves. So I think, one of the key principles of this initiative, it's about individuals claiming the rights that are really theirs, and doing that against the powers that be, and of course those powers in Israeli politics will be against it. But where do struggles start? If there's nobody who opposes you, then you should be able to walk through the door and get what you want. So it has to start somewhere, and I suppose that as I tried to suggest, the idea would be that if you could begin to build up some momentum for this idea on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli side, and it has to be a local thing. It can't be something, which people outside come and push the Israelis and Palestinians to do. It has to be something which comes from them. Then you begin to have a force which could be strengthened by things outside. And here, we begin to come to other controversial issues like boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Action that individuals can take outside to bring the kind of pressure in the world at large which could help this movement go forward. Whilst at the moment, yes, the Israeli political situation looks as if it's huge monster in the room that's pushing, that will just kind of trample on this idea, that may not necessarily be the case as we go forward. And I think, we've got the Israeli election coming up very shortly. It seems to me the only positive development that we've seen is this coming together of the Arab parties, right, to make a bloc. And one of the people involved in this initiative, Avram Borg, the former speaker, has joined this group, and I think that's a significant development, because it seems to me, even though I think that group is probably, its policy on the future is still two states, nonetheless, if they could be persuaded that this was a campaign that they would take up, well, then you would have a significant, you know, you could have a significant voice within the Israeli political system, which would be arguing for it as well. So, and your second point about a palliative, what, perhaps you just repeat, what do you
mean? I said the cynic might argue that this design would actually, prevent serious discussion and progress of the two-state solution.
Yeah. Well, I think, but that comes back to the fact that, well, there's no serious discussion anyway, and so, you're starting from a base where at least, you know, get something moving. And I think if indeed it did come from a few intellectuals sitting around talking for a few years, well, you know, it will just die out. But I think it's too early to say. And in answer to your question, Ellen, why Israelis on the left are opposed? Well, when you say that, I mean, in a way, this particular equal rights agenda idea is not something which I think is in any been presented to the Israeli left, for whatever's left of the left in Israel, in any concrete way whatsoever. Yes, obviously, I dare say, if you went to people, you know, if you went to the people in the Labour Party and put this, you know, aside to them, whether they would dismiss it out of hand, I doubt they could leave this out of hand, but they wouldn't see it as a kind of practical option. I mean, partly because of the fact that they can't talk about these kinds of things at the moment. I mean, you know, the election that's going on is such that peace, occupation, these are words that are not being spoken about, as if this is something, you know, some other issue. You know, they're arguing about who's more Zionist than the other. So I think it's a bit early to sort of write off also the left. You know, there are, I do see some people writing about, oh, well, actually, no, the left in Israel is reviving. Well, you know, I wish it was. But and if there is some possibility of a revival, maybe this idea might begin to have some traction, if there is an understanding that on the left, on the more mainstream left, the two-state solution is simply not going anywhere. Obviously, they're still very wedded to that idea.
What about the minority issue?
The issue,
I think the main concern that I've always heard about this is the Jews will be in the minority, laws will change, and the Jews will lose their rights, and they will be oppressed again.
But in what framework? I mean, the question, are you assuming that there would be one single state?
Is that under one single state with the right of return, the Jews will lose them, be in the minority.
Right, but first of all, I mean, since I'm presenting the ideas of this group, they are not advocating a one-state solution. They're saying, maybe I didn't make this clear enough in my remarks, but they're saying, you know, we're not talking about constitutional arrangements at the moment. Because all that talk of constitutionalism and states and so on, they regard as a failed discourse. It's not getting anywhere. And therefore, you know, they're starting with the rights. And they're saying that, you know, let's work for equal rights. And then once we begin to, you know, if we can achieve something in that direction, then we will start talking about, okay, what is going to be the constitutional arrangement which secures those rights for all the people. It may be one state, but it may not. It may be a federation, it may be a confederation, it may be some kind of binational state, it may be shared sovereignty. There are actually quite a lot of options. And it may well be that in one of those options, you could still at least begin a new constitutional arrangement where there is a Jewish majority in that part of this, say, let's say it's a federal structure, right? So you would hold, obviously, in the Israeli side of it, the Jewish side of it, you would have a Jewish majority. Now, obviously, you couldn't guarantee that majority under these kinds of principles, because these principles are saying to both the Palestinians and the Israelis, if they had two conjoined states, they wouldn't be able to have laws of return which are exclusive to their own peoples. They would have to have some liberal-based immigration control system, or you could have something along the lines of, I don't know whether I mentioned it in my remarks, that, you know, this has been proposed, of having a law which prioritizes, because of, I mean, in terms of the law of return in Israel, it's defended, you know, fundamentally these days, not only, you know, because this is the state of the Jews everywhere, they should have the right to come. It's last refuge, it's, you know, in cases of persecution, and with the, you know, with the concern about anti-Semitism today, the Israelis are using that quite a lot. But you could have two states where the laws in both states were such that you would privilege both national groups or both ethnic groups in terms of immigration, so that you would still have that fundamental function of these states as being protective of the people of those national and ethnic groups. But there is no, they aren't, just to come back again, they're not saying one state, they're saying let's wait and see and then determine what the constitutional arrangement should be.
Yeah, we'll do it here and here. And you've got lots of questions coming. Yeah,
right. Go ahead. So I'm Alan Wolf. Well, I'm trying to imagine how these ideas, which I'm sort of hearing for the first time, would go over in the context of American politics, because ultimately the U.S. would have to be a player somewhere in here. And it strikes me, I mean, you mentioned in response to a question that other presidents have had shown more freedom of action with respect to Israel than the current one. But if you're talking about Bush Sr. or someone like that, that was in a very different era, mm-hmm. when you had Arab oil money in the Republican Party. You had realists like Ben Scowcroft and James Baker advising presidents. Now, as we've seen in the events of the last week and a half, it's the Christian right that's dominating the Israel discussion. The unprecedented steps of 47 senators writing to the Iranians and inviting Netanyahu. I mean, there's a whole new actor playing a major role here. And so I'm listening to you, I'm saying, what would the Christian right think about what you said? And the two things that immediately come to mind are that it is a firm conviction that human beings can't take rights for themselves, that rights are always given by God. So the idea of peoples claiming rights would be sort of completely anathema. And then the other thing would be that in this area between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, there just aren't any Christians left. So Christians wouldn't have any vested interest in protecting rights. It would just be the rights of others, the rights of Muslims and the rights of Jews. And I've never seen the evangelical right. When they talk about religious rights, they're almost entirely talking about Christian persecution. Mm-hmm. So I see nothing in there that would appeal in any way to what I believe is, because with the fracturing of Jewish politics much more in the United States, the Christian right is going to be the major influence on any U.S. policy toward Israel in the next 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Alan, do you want to?
Yeah, so I'm always...
Please introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Ellen Messer, I'm an anthropologist. And as I said to you on the line before, I worked on water and food issues in the 1990s in Israel, Palestine, and so I'm just wondering to what extent those who are dealing with these political principles from the top down are trying to build on what were essentially grassroots professional infrastructures, trying to work from the bottom up to work on a problem of not just rights to water, but the economic and political institutions with respect for culture, demands for water, that also were growing up in the 1990s. Is there a way in which the innovative ideas and principles that you're developing can build on some of this grassroots energy from the 1990s? And then I want to throw something else out, which is that huge problem on both on the Israeli side and also on the Palestinian side are rights for women. So I'm just wondering how this equal rights is addressing the women's issues.
Why don't you take those? We've got a couple on the table. And well, we've got three more. There's lots more to go.
Okay,
yeah.
Your questions are getting more difficult as we go along.
It's a trap. We lure you in with the honey.
Yeah. Well, I can't claim to be in any way an expert on American politics and the Christian writing. I obviously, what you say must be correct. But I mean, there's a sense in which, that phenomenon that you're talking about, can act as a blocking mechanism, right? If one accepted the premise that it's possible to get a grassroots movement off the ground in Israel Palestine, what are the Christian right going to do about that? I mean, what can they do about that? I mean, they can't stop it. They can't, there's nothing they can do directly. I understand, obviously, they're powerful, but I mean, how would that play out on the level of the power of any president? I mean, could a situation arise here in America where you had a president who was actually just a clone of the Christian right, or simply a puppet of the Christian right, or would you as American politics seem to go, you always have somebody, even if they're on the right, who has to take a more kind of centrist position. So I'm sort of not quite sure that it could prevent this idea taking hold in some ways. Whether it would, whether when it gets to a point where outside actors have to be brought in, well, then obviously what happens here in America becomes important. But it seems to me that they need to do, the people who are involved in this need to work on this. But that you could get quite a long way in establishing some new. I won't say new status quo, but putting facts on the ground as far as working towards equal rights, which would begin to make it difficult for outside powers to come. I mean, say for example, the EU. Makes a decision that it's going to come into this in a major way, and if America goes more to the right, This may give the EU more of a sense that it needs to intervene more in Middle Eastern politics. It hasn't helped. It did at one time. In the 1980s there was a Venice Declaration, which was quite significant in terms of recognizing Palestinian rights. There was a huge fuss about it at the time. I remember. So I think there are other maybe forces around which might. I would add something else here, and that is, of course, that I understand, obviously, the American power is still significant no matter what, even if it's not being used. But we are in a situation in the world where new priorities, new constellations, new geopolitical things are going on, which have already taken away the focus that there's been for decades on the Israel-Palestine thing. And why has Netanyahu been able to get away with what he's done to a large degree? For obviously a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons is that people's focus is elsewhere now with ISIS and these other developments. And I think that's probably going to continue. I'm not a great political scientist or know a lot about geopolitics and so on, but my common sense reading of it is that I don't think there's going to be a coming back of interest in the Israel-Palestine thing itself. So they may begin to have actually more freedom of manoeuvre in some ways to proceed with what they might want to do. Your question, Alan, about the grassroots. I mean, I would have thought that this initiative would have to link up with those. I mean, I don't think there's any sense that the people, you know, I've met who are involved in this are thinking that, you know, that this is something which will go over the heads of these initiatives that you're talking about. And indeed, surely they would have to be part of the model for what they would need to be doing, because those people who've been engaged in those projects on the ground are the ones that have got the experience in putting together any sense of encouraging any sense of empowerment on the part of, you know, people on the ground. Those initiatives have experience in that. They've got some track record in that. So I would have thought that the Equal Rights Initiative, once it, if it gets as far as saying, okay, how are we going to build this movement, it would have to take those things into account. And I would point out that this, there's a conference taking place at the end of this week in London, at which this equal rights agenda is going to be discussed, and some of the Palestinians and the Israelis are going to be there. And one of the sessions that's going to be at that conference is indeed bringing together some of the people who you're talking about, who are involved in grassroots initiatives, and talking about, you know, how they see this equal rights agenda and how their experience might be used within the context of it. So I think it's a very significant point you make, and I don't think that this idea would get very far at all unless it was going to tap into those sorts of experiences. I mean, as you say, we were talking on the line as we were going in to get something to eat. I mean, we also know that quite a lot of those initiatives are very difficult to undertake at the moment because of the restrictions, B, because the sense of disillusionment, but also, you know, there is this feeling among the Palestinians, and I think, you know, one has to understand this very well, of being against normalization. You know, this is quite a significant thing, that there's been so many decades of disappointment, and all of these initiatives where people of genuine sympathy and genuine concern, you know, come and help, it's not getting anywhere. And therefore, you know, sort of this kind of, as we're fraternizing with people from outside who are involved in these kinds of initiatives, obviously helps those communities on the ground in terms of water and, I don't know, property, all those kinds of things. But it maybe it's just a kind of a sticking plaster, and is impeding any, you know, serious move towards the kind of thing that Palestinians really want and really, really deserve. But, you know, having said that, it would have to, I think, build on and use it, the experience of those people.
Okay, did you have your hand up? Brie, we'll try to get one, two, three. And then the question on women.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. No. God, that's terrible. I'm sorry. I think that well, I mean, I know that certainly. Well, I just would be wrong simply to say that I know that the women involved in this initiative, they're all feminists, but I mean, as if to imply, well, the men aren't, or something of that kind. But no, I mean, my sense of reading the material and knowing some of the people is that there is absolutely no question that when they're talking about rights here, they're also talking about women's rights, that it's not something which is just, you know, being pushed under the table or ignored. And I think in some of the conversations I've had one or two of these people, you know, them talking about how important it is that that, you know, if you're talking about an equal rights agenda, it obviously has to have the issue of women right at the very heart and centre of it. So I don't think that there's any suggestion, simply because, you know, the materials being produced by these kinds of initiatives are not yet so fully formed that there's, you know, a tremendous amount having been written about it. I mean, that doesn't imply, I think, that there isn't concern of that women's rights have to be at the heart of it. I'm sure it is.
Okay, we're getting toward the end of our session, so yes. We'll try to be.
I'm Adam Thomas. I'm a political science graduate student. I guess my question takes off from your response, I believe, to her question. That it's not a, you know, one shouldn't confuse this equal rights solution with a one state solution. But it seems to me it's hard for me to envision what a regime of equal rights looks like short of something like a one state solution, simply because to me equal rights means equal political rights, voting rights, representation, this kinds of thing. What are the precise equal rights that are going to be secured in this sort of pre-constitutional sort of situation? Could you sort of list what they are?
I'm not a human rights expert or human rights lawyer, so I couldn't produce a list. But I can say all, you know, what any other liberal democratic society would regard as appropriate, which is indeed the full panoply of human, civil, economic, social rights. Now, I don't see that it's necessarily that it has to be wedded to one state or to one unitary state. I mean, surely if you look around the world, there are different structures where. You know, you have this. I mean, surely here in America, I mean, the whole, you've got the states and you've got the federal structure. You've got the federal authority. And my understanding from, as I say, I'm not an expert on American politics, is that, you know, states' rights and are very strong. There's a very strong tradition of states' rights. Yet, however, you know, the notion that America as a whole is a place where it's understood that equal rights for everybody is important, even though it's not necessarily the same in every state, and there's still struggles going on for that. Nevertheless, you know, the thrust always is, it's got to be the same for everybody. And it's even though we have, we are a federal structure, and, you know, individual states have a lot of power. I mean, you could see the EU in a similar kind of a way. Obviously, it's not the same, because although Eurosceptics like to paint it as this sort of super state. Some people would like it to be a super state. It certainly isn't that at the moment. But you've got a shared sovereignty there now, in the EU, and also an attempt to develop a state of rights across the whole of the European Union. And any country that wants to join the European Union has to make certain commitments as far as human rights are concerned. I mean, I would even take what's happening in the United Kingdom for a moment, where you've had devolution now for 20 years with Scotland and Wales. Okay, so you're starting from a kind of more unitary way, but power is being devolved. Very significant power has now been devolved to the Scots. More power is going to be devolved to the Welsh. The Northern Irish have got lots of power already on their own. But again, there's still this notion that you can have a culture and a state of rights all the way around. So I don't think it's got to be, either one state or it's two states. I think you can be creative and think of other ways in which you'd be able to safeguard these rights, not necessarily in one unitary state.
Let's get the other two questions on the table here.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I found this explanation very helpful for certain movements that are going on within the High Court, and also with many activist groups and groups working in Israel are sort of working towards, sort of explained what I was seeing. And I apologize beforehand if I already missed where you covered this. It leaves me with some concerns in this sort of shifting a paradigm from a national conflict to two nationalities vying with one another towards a paradigm of your comment about civil rights in this country was very, very generative for me and sort of revealing. And I wonder both if that wouldn't get what each party wants a little bit wrong, but by way of description, just based on my 3 years living in Israel and 1 year living in Palestine, when I talked to people, I didn't hear Israelis very bothered about a lack of equal rights. And I didn't hear Palestinians very happy it wouldn't have been enough if they got equal rights within the current framework. There was more resentment against the very power structure itself. What was required was something totally different from what existed. And so I wonder if that wouldn't fail to harness the desires of both sides on a sort of broad political level. It sounds very good from afar. I'm not sure if people would get excited about it and say, yes, I want this. Now, if you ask them, do they want water? In the short term, sure, I want access to water if I'm a Palestinian. Sure, but... and then I wonder if it wouldn't actually have a somewhat generative effect of handling it as an issue of equal rights, actually creating a context sort of analogous to what we have in terms of racist dynamics in this country or in South Africa. If we handle it under the discourse of equal rights, and then it becomes a decades-long fight for equal access to all kinds of resources in society, and prejudicial systems are what we're fighting, when the conflict was actually one about nationalism, right? And so I'm worried about it generating a different kind of problem, having not gotten what the original problem was when two peoples were set in conflict with each other.
Could you introduce yourself also?
I'm sorry. I'm Stephen. I'm sorry.
No problem.
I'm Stephen Slater. I'm a rabbinical student at Hebrew College, a rabbinical school here in Boston, a few miles away.
Terrific. Welcome. And Eve, what's your
name? Oh, okay. We are probably not going to have enough time. Let him answer that, and then if we have enough time, come back to me.
Go ahead and put
it in. Okay. So a quick comment question, and then my real question. And the quick comment question is whether the Kreisky group drew in for work like that of Salman Abu Sitta and other people who do research on the Palestinian refugees, because that research pretty consistently suggests that's not going to be the big issue that rhetorically it often is for Israeli politicians, both because all the survey data indicates that a relatively small number of people want to be repatriated. They want some kind of resolution, but repatriation is not generally the preferred choice of the younger generation who are, you know, who have the rights of refugees devolved from their grandparents but not from their own experience. And also that what Salman Abu Sitta really shows is that almost all the land that Israel has cordoned off as closed military zones and natural nature reserves are where the villages were, so that the principle of returning without creating new injustices could be met without much difficulty. So the small question is, was that work part of the deliberations of the Kreisky group? But the other question I'm curious about is a sort of ethnographic question. Are you there often, and what do you hear? Because the voices you speak of, I am there often, and so where I hear it is there's a huge generational shift. This is virtually never heard among people of the age of most of the people around, in the inner circle around the table, maybe more on the folks sitting out here. So there's a generational shift, and I'm wondering if you think that voice, because of the generation in which it's situated, can emerge strongly enough in the likelihood that any transition is not going to be this nice, orderly, people talking in a civil way, mutually persuading one another, you know, drawing the EU or the UN in. What I think very likely might happen is a collapse of the PA and a very chaotic situation, and then the strategic value of people who have some vision that offers a possible resolution that might come as a huge relief in a very chaotic situation. Is it your sort of ethnographic experience on the ground that these people are moving fast enough in large enough numbers, close enough to seats of power, that they might be an alternative voice if there were a collapse of the PA and a reoccupation of the Area A cities and a very messy situation, not a polite, cumulative conversation.
Yeah, that's good, important question.
Good. Thank you.
So to come, if I start at the last thing that you said in relation to where you sort of compared the situation with South Africa and the kind of long struggle. I sensed that you were saying that would not be a good thing. Because that would somehow be taking away the focus on it being a national struggle to a different kind of struggle, and Is that because you see? It seems to me that I'd hesitate to get here into an argument about apartheid. You know, whether Israeli apartheid and so on. But I still think, irrespective of that, what happened in South Africa with the struggle for equal rights is indeed an example of what might have to happen as far as Israel-Palestine is concerned, because I don't see the privileges and the status quo that exists there being dismantled very easily at all. I mean, you know, there are a lot of discussions about, well, you know, some people say, well, no, if the Israeli army wanted to get rid of the settlers, you know, if there was a decision they'd get rid of the settlers tomorrow and so on. I mean, I don't buy that kind of argument at all. I think that is, not seeing the reality of what's happening either to the army, which is now heavily, you know, dominated by Orthodox Jews, and whether any you'd ever get a government coming into power that have the will to do that. So, you know, if you're going to have a struggle, then the example of South Africa seems to be quite a good one. It was to great degree, you know, coming from the ground up in South Africa, and it was supported by forces outside, many of which were civil society forces, because a lot of governments for a while paid lip service to the idea that they were going to do something about the situation in South Africa and weren't doing anything. So I think the question of because I think you in this emphasis on it, on, you know, concentrating on the issue of this being a national conflict, I think what this group is trying to suggest is that there is a way round it was a national conflict from the beginning, and that has been the pattern that has followed through since then, and that was very much fueled and aggravated by the predominance of the idea of partition, which, you know, that's how Israel was formed, because the United Nations said that there should be partition. But what this group emphasizes, as I tried to say in my remarks, is that the idea of partition is in a way moot now because of this binational reality that is on the ground, where there is this intertwining. It's an oppressive, it's not a happy intertwining, obviously, but it is an intertwining, because obviously, you know, you're taking the West Bank the settlements are guarded, and you've got Jewish only roads, but there's still clashes and there's still interaction of one kind or another between Palestinians and Israelis. So I think that their feeling is that they can. That it is possible to reach an accommodation and understanding on the question of nationalisms, and that there is, I think, a discourse in the things that they've said and the things that they're writing, which does tend towards a sort of notion of moving towards the idea towards a kind of civic patriotism, rather than, I mean, that's not a concept which, you know, many people would necessarily appreciate either on the Palestinian side or on the Israeli side, but nonetheless is one that, you know, the people involved in this group think is something. I get the sense that that is what they would like to move towards, so that, you know, people can keep their sort of the kind of fundamental national feeling that no one is going to say. I mean, personally, I'm very kind of anti-nationalism, but I'm realist and I recognise that, you know, a lot of people like it and they can't do without it. It's sort of a kind of a drug. So, you know, just because we don't like it, it's not going to go away, and it's not going to go away in Israel-Palestine. But you could get to a situation where ultimately, through the struggle for equal rights, you neutralize the negative elements of the nationalism which the two national movements have kind of pursued up to now. So I don't know whether I'm answering your question, but I try to contextualize it a bit and say perhaps that it's not, you know, at the end of the day, it won't necessarily be the national issue which will be most important. It will be the thing that I understand, you know, many Palestinians are coming back to, is that, because, I mean, things to do with water and housing and, you know, whether their homes are demolished or not, is to do with whether we have rights and whether they can, I mean, they can't, you know, when their homes are demolished, there's no one they can appeal to because this is a law, you know, it's rare to say this is legal. I mean, it's legal because they took this draconian bit of action from the British, because that's what they did before 48. Anyway, so that's that. And finally, the general... Oh, sorry, you want me to stop?
I think
stop?
We need to wrap up.
Sorry,
yeah,
sorry.
People have been... But maybe we can address personally the question right after this.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Apologize about that. But thank you all for being here, and thank you very much, Jonathan.